black architects, Albert Cassell, who headed the architecture department at Howard University. Rest in power, Charles Cassell. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 89 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 77 degrees with light rain. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is 5 p.m. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches, enough welfare for everyone.
A whole lot of police cars, those lights flashing red. That's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the voice of Humphrey Bogart as the craggy but idealistic newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA. He's telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and I've taken that fine movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. The State Attorney General's office is one of the places where reporters dine out for good stories. It's an office that often makes news going up against big targets, making cases against predatory lenders, bad landlords, monopolies that prey on the public. The current New York State Attorney General is even working on a criminal case against Donald Trump in tandem with the Manhattan DA. But for many years, going back to the 1940s, the office was held by Republicans and was mostly a low-key and somewhat sleepy corner of state government. The office had been long-headed by a happy-go-lucky guy named Louis Lefkowitz, who was a great street campaigner and a backslapper, but whose credo seemed to be never rock the boat. And then, in 1978, a man named Robert Abrams, a Democrat, won the office. Bob Abrams had served in the state assembly, and he'd been Bronx borough president, and along the way he'd earned a reputation as a liberal and a very hard-working public official. But it wasn't until he became attorney general that New Yorkers began to find out what could actually be accomplished with that office. As AG, Bob Abrams promptly launched the state into areas where his predecessors had largely feared to tread. He famously went aggressively after the corporate polluters who had turned a neighborhood near Buffalo called Love Canal into a metaphor for toxic waste. He filed charges against a Brooklyn thermometer manufacturer that was poisoning its workers by tossing deadly mercury around, almost as though it was nothing more dangerous than old bald tires. And when aggressive anti-abortion protesters, the so-called Operation Rescue Group, as it was called, tried to violently disrupt clinics in New York State, Abrams brought injunctions against them. He also brought civil rights cases against private clubs that were barring African Americans. He filed antitrust actions against credit card companies that were trying to monopolize the business. He even sued the heavily mob-dominated concrete industry in New York and the private garbage carting business, which was also organized crime-controlled. Looking back now, we take this kind of activist posture of attorney generals for granted, that they're the ones who are going to step in when the federal government refuses to show up to help, as that's what Ronald Reagan's administration was doing back when Abrams was attorney general. But in fact, it took a lot of vision for what the office could be, and not a little chutzpah, as they might say up on Pelham Parkway in the Bronx, where Bob Abrams came from. And amazingly, Bob Abrams did all this and remained a pretty well-liked guy by most New Yorkers, unlike the snarling sheriffs of Wall Street types that have succeeded him. He's now written a book about all this. He calls it The Luckiest Guy in the World, My Journey in Politics. And we're going to ask him about that luckiest guy business and a bunch of other things during our conversation this evening. Bob, welcome to the show.
Tom, thanks for the invitation. And I appreciate it very much. You're going through some of the stuff that we try to do during my 15 years as Attorney General of New York.
All right. Well, that was the nice part. Now we're going to get tough. I was going to ask you about, you showed a very creative political touch right from the beginning of your political career. In your first campaign for state assembly in the Bronx, you bought several thousand fortune cookies, and you had a certain message printed and placed inside. What was that message?
Well, the message was, first of all, I had to get the attention of voters. You got to get the context for this. I was a 27-year-old kid. I was 2 years out of law school. I never dreamt about running for public office. My father and mother worked in a candy store, in a luncheonette, 6 days a week, early in the morning to late at night. I didn't know the right people. You know, I was a reformed Democrat, an insurgent. I didn't have money. I mean, so I was in this David and Goliath race. I challenged my local assemblyman, who was a 17-year incumbent, the chairman of the most powerful committee in the assembly, the Ways and Means Committee. And so how does this kid running against the party machine, break through? How do you win? How do you stand the
chance? Fortune cookies.
So I came up with this idea of Chinese fortune cookies. I didn't have a lot of money, but I could afford 10,000 fortune cookies. And we told the factory that made the fortune cookies, look, put in this message, your good fortune would be Bob Abrams for the assembly. And I walked around the park benches in my old neighborhood in Pelham Parkway, along Bronx Park East and along Pelham Parkway. A lot of the senior citizens who had spare time would sit on those benches. And I'd say, hi, I'm Bob Abrams. I'm the independent reform Democratic candidate running for the state assembly. And, by the way, why don't you have a fortune cookie? They look, well, what's that? And they'd reach into the box and they'd take a fortune cookie and then they'd open it up and then they'd see the fortune. They'd smile. And that would give me my opening. Well, you know, I'm running for this. Do you know who your assemblyman is? Do you know? And most of the people didn't even know the name. And they said, well, no, tell me who it is. I won't tell you. I won't tell you. You know why you don't know? It's not your fault. It's his fault. He's not around. He doesn't show up. He doesn't send out newsletters. He doesn't do anything on behalf of the district. And then I'd start my little rap and my pitch, and I'd shake their hands. And, you try to get a little warmth going. And I had to do whatever I could to try to generate interest in the race, letting people know who I was, why this was important. And lo and behold, on primary night, I was able to win.
Yes. And credit to the fortune cookies. So listen, on the cover of your book, on the jacket of your book, The Luckiest Guy in the World, there is this wonderful black and white photo that shows you holding a microphone. There's a young boy next to you who seems to be clutching a bunch of flyers. And you're both standing in front of this sedan, and on the car's roof is a loudspeaker and a sign reading, Beat Buckley Bossism, Abrams for Assembly. Who was Buckley, and what was he boss of, and why did you want to beat him?
Okay, great question. So Buckley was Charlie Buckley. He was a congressman. He was a long-term congressman. He was in Congress for 30 years. He was the chairman of the Public Works Committee. He was also the boss of the Bronx, the leader of the Democratic Party in the Bronx. And he was a very powerful guy.
And how did that power play out, Bob? What did that mean to ordinary Democrats?
Well, first of all, he was the wielder of power through the machine, and machine politics. So what's machine politics? It's the politics of those in control, of nominations. You know, he had control as to who's going to be nominated for public office, for the assembly, for the legislature, for Congress. He had power over the judiciary, who was going to be nominated for judge. He had influence over citywide and state elections and even national elections. And because the Bronx was a big place, a bastion of Democrats, and so he would wield his power. And then there were a lot of abuses because people would get nominations not based upon, you know, their ability to do the job or the desire for hard work and do the right thing and represent the interests of people. They got it because, you know, they were a crony of the district leader, of the boss of the Bronx. And then they owe their allegiance. Since they got the nomination, they owe their vote and their allegiance to whatever the boss wants. I served in the assembly. I saw sometimes there would be phone calls in the back on an important banking bill, and the sergeant-at-arms would be handing out slips of paper, and guys would go to the back and receive phone calls from the banks, the presidents of the banks, because there was an important bill on the floor, and they would want you to vote a certain way. And then they would also get a vote maybe from the boss of the Bronx or the district leader. So the machine had a lot of power and a lot of control. And then they had things, what were called no-show jobs. There were people placed on the payroll. You got a job in the Congress, in the city council, in the state legislature, and you never showed up. You'd get your paycheck, but you'd never do anything for the work. So these were the kinds of abuses in the old line machine. And there were a couple of people in New York, great names, Eleanor Roosevelt, Herbert Leibman, two octogenarians, though they were in their 80s when they were leading this fight. We got to do something about the Democratic Party. We got to cleanse it. We got to clean out the crud and get rid of the bosses and bring in some fresh new blood, younger people, fresh ideas, the right kind of thing, good government principles and concepts. And so I joined that movement. It started in the west side of Manhattan with Jerry Kretschmer and Al Blumenthal and William Fitzryan, and it spread to the to Brooklyn and the Bronx and Queens a little bit. And people were elected. You know, before I ran for the assembly, Jonathan Bingham upset Charlie Buckley. Jim Scheuer upset Jim Healey in the Bronx, and Liz Holtzman upset Manny Seller in Brooklyn. But it might interest people too, Tom, and you. Well, if you read the book, then you know as to, you know, how I came, you know, how Buckley entered my life, and how I came to make that race for the assembly and give out fortune cookies. I was a student at Columbia College, and I took this government course. And the professor was a prominent guy, David B. Truman. He later became the dean of the college and later became the vice provost or the provost of Columbia University. And he gave an assignment to the class. He said, look, I want you all to do a report on your congressional district. Tell me what that district is. What's the number of the district? What are the boundaries of the district? Who lives in the district? What's the socioeconomic makeup of the district? Who is the representative in that district? What are the political currents and flows within that district? Then he said, and I want you to interview your member of Congress. So, I was a diligent student. I said, okay, I knew my congressman was Charlie Buckley. I'm going to interview Congressman Buckley. So I went to look in the phone book to find out the phone number of his district office. And lo and behold, I find out there's no district office. He doesn't have a district office. So, I'll call his office in Washington. So I called, and I left my name. I told him who I was. I'm a constituent of Congressman Buckley. I'm a student at Columbia College. I have this paper. I want to interview the congressman. Can I speak to somebody about this? I called once. I called twice. I called three times. I left a message. No one calls me back. And to make a long story short, I had a hand in the paper. I never interviewed my congressman. And I thought that my grade might have suffered a little bit. Maybe Professor Truman thought that I didn't work hard enough or try hard enough to get the interview. And so, you know, I finished the course. I finished college. I'm in law school. I'm at NYU Law School. And Francis W.H. Adams, who was one of the leaders in the reform movement, former police commissioner, he threw a reception for NYU law students. And he gathered all of us together and said, look, you men and women are going to become lawyers, but it's not enough just to be a lawyer. You've got to be active in the community. If you want change, if you want reform, if you want improvement in the local community or on the larger national or international level, you've got to fight for reform and change. You've got to be part of the political process. So look, get involved in local politics. And then after the reception, they sent the names of everybody who came to the reception to the local Reform Democratic clubs that we're developing. And I get this call from somebody, and they say, hi, you're Bob Abrams? Yes, yes, you attended that reception? Yes. Well, I'm from the Bronx Pelham Reform Democratic Club. We're at 708 Leidig Avenue, right up the steps from the Chinese restaurant. I said, yeah, I know where that is. I know. He said, well, we'd like you to get involved in the campaign. I said, well, you know, look, I went to that reception. It was great, and it was very interesting. But, you know, I'm very busy. I got a lot of things on my plate. I'm not sure I have time right now. Maybe someday in the future, not right now, to be involved in a campaign. Oh, you got to be involved in the campaign. We have some very good races going on for party and public office. I said, look, it sounds good, and I like what Commissioner Adams said, and I do think it's important, but I really don't have the time. I really don't. And the person said, oh, but this is a critical moment. We're running very good candidates, important offices. You know, we're challenging the congressman in the district. We're challenging Charlie Buckley. And I said, what did you say? We're running a race against Charlie Buckley. That son of a bitch. You got me. And that's what got me into politics. That was my first political race, and I ran. I worked for David Leiby, who ran against Charlie Buckley.
Memo to incumbent office holders, always return that phone call from a constituent when they're trying to call you. So just a reminder to folks, this is Deadline NYC. That's the name of the show. My name is Tom Robbins, but more importantly, I'm talking to Bob Abrams, the former New York State Attorney General. We're here on WBAI 99.5 FM. So after being in the Assembly for a few years, you raised the money to buy a few more fortune cookies, and you ran and won the office of Bronx Borough President. And
You're right, Tom. I mean, the Bronx is made up of 12 assembly districts. It was 1.5 million people. It was a big place. First of all, a lot of people didn't realize, you know, how large the Bronx was. I used to have this litany. I say the borough of the Bronx is has 1.5 million people. It's larger than many states in the union. It's larger than every city but four in America. It's larger than countries that have membership in the United Nations. You know, so it's a big place, 12 different assembly districts. So I said, look, I don't want to fight success. Those fortune cookies got me to shake hands on Pelham Parkway. Now I had to go to the Grand Concourse, and I had to go to the South Bronx and the West Bronx and the North Bronx. So I ordered 25,000 fortune cookies, and I went out to shake some more hands. And it was a tough challenge because the machine put up a very strong candidate, a guy named Billy Kappelman. He had been a state assemblyman, and he was a judge. He stepped down from the bench to make this race. And again, I was never supposed to win. I was the underdog. I was underfunded. And he had, you know, all the clout of the machine and the institution of big, strong clubs all around the county. But I was lucky. I worked very hard. You know, I used to do, we didn't talk about this yet, I used to do subway stops. How does an, look, it was so different from today's politics. I didn't have a lot of money. There was no polling. There was no television. There was no radio. There was no internet. I mean, it was what I called hand-to-hand combat. I had to shake hands of people. So how did I do that? How can you do that? So I went to subways in the morning. I got up at 5 in the morning, was at a subway stop at 5:30, and I did it till 7:30, 8 o'clock, when people from the neighborhood, you know, went to the subway to go to work. And then when the subway stops were over, I went to the parks. I went first to the local schools where the mothers were bringing their kids to kindergarten and to the first grade. And then I went to the parks where people would be sitting, you know, during the day. And I went to the senior citizen center. So it was hand-to-hand combat, gave out those fortune cookies again. And then I did coffee clutches at night. I'd get volunteers of people. Oh, can I come to your apartment? Can you bring people in your building into your apartment? Can I introduce myself to them? Let me tell them
all
who
right.
I am.
Well, you were great at this grassroots politics. There's no question about that because you won. But one of the things I got to ask is that sometimes maybe you might have felt like you have to be careful what you wish for, because you became leader of a borough that was suffering greatly, and neighborhoods were deteriorating, arson was beginning to rise, and I was interested in the book to see that you had singled out two powerful industries, mortgage bankers and insurance companies, and you would denounce them for their practices. It's something called redlining, a phrase that we don't hear too often these days. But what was going on that made you decide to go after those folks, and what was the response to your demands to them?
Right. So redlining was the concept of a bank putting red lines on a map around certain areas where they said, we're not going to lend. We're not going to give mortgages in that area because we think it's too risky. Look, it's a legitimate issue for a bank. They have to be careful. They're fiduciaries about the deposits that people leave in the bank. But what the banks did was they went beyond being too cautious. They were pejorative. They were hostile to minority neighborhoods. They were hostile. They redlined virtually the whole Bronx. Because they thought it was more secure to lend money to states in the South, you know, to states in the Midwest, and the Sun Belt at that time. The Sun Belt was being built up, and so they were taking Bronxites' money and building up communities in Phoenix, Arizona, and Atlanta, Georgia, and other places to the detriment of the Bronx. So when landlords wanted to try to rehab the building, invest a little more money, put in a new boiler, fix the roof, put in some new fixtures, they didn't get the money. They couldn't get the money. And when it came time to insure their property, they may have had trouble from insurance companies and redlining. So it was a big issue. I had a wonderful staff. There was a fantastic guy, and I think you knew who he was, Paul DeBruhl, a brilliant mm-hmm. guy who gave me all kinds of data, and Hunter College put together data too. And we issued a report showing, demonstrating how money of Bronxites was being shipped out of state and hurting neighborhoods. They were neighborhoods we were being allowed to deteriorate and to be run down and decline. And so, we put pressure on the banks. They fought back. My father gave me a call one day. Bobby, did you see those ads? You know, he felt for me. He was such a wonderful man. He was my best friend, my dad. He felt for me, and it was a tough thing. I never thought I'd get into politics, and politics can be a tough business. And so anytime people said bad things about me or rumors would fly, he'd call me up, and I'd try to hold his hand. Daddy, I know it's going to be hard, but we'll persevere. You taught me that good guys win in the end, and look, we just got to hang tough. So he calls me this day and says, did you see those ads that the banks took out in all the Bronx newspapers? Big full-page ads, a Bronx politician is trying to destroy the money on a deposit in Bronx banks. And they didn't have facts. We really had the facts. Paul DeBruhl gave me the facts. And we were able to come back and say, this is a lie. This is a problem for them. Let them show you the records. Where is the money going? And everything in the Bronx is not a bad risk. Yes, there are some risky places in the Bronx, but these neighborhoods are not. And if it is a bad risk, maybe you charge a little higher interest rate or whatever. And the Bronx, and they even didn't want to build, for the city university. Lehman College got some money, to expand the college facilities, to build a new library and a performing arts center. And during the fiscal crisis, they cut out the funds. And we put so much pressure on the banks to say, well, demonstrate your good faith now by lending some money so that we can complete the project, the steel that's up there that the city was threatening to pull down, that was going to be the basis for the new library and the Performing Arts Center, and we got the banks to fund, that project and some other projects. So it was, you're right, Tom, it was a tough struggle, and I wasn't able to stem all of the deterioration. I worked hard. I was an activist. I did the best I could. I dramatized the issue. I put pressure on institutions. But
one of the things I would just point out is it must have felt a little bit like you were sort of all alone at that point. Was there much help coming from City Hall or the state or the federal government at that point in terms of stemming neighborhood decay?
Well, you remember that headline, I think it was 1974, Ford to New York City dropped dead. So there were real problems in getting adequate resources. It still is a problem today. New York always sent more money to the federal government than it sent back to the state and the Bronx. And New York City had a problem, and within New York City, the Bronx had a problem. So, I had to be an activist and an advocate to try to argue on behalf, and I try to organize communities. That's one of the things I did. I try to mobilize citizens, get them to come to the Board of Estimate to testify on behalf of capital projects, schools and housing and hospitals. You know, we didn't talk about this yet, but there was this problem of health care in the South Bronx. There was an old, dilapidated Lincoln Hospital with rats running through the hospital. And I committed myself that if I ever became successful in this primary and in the general election to be the borough president, I was determined to build a decades-old promised Lincoln Hospital. It was always on the drawing books, but it never got built. And it took me 4 or 5 years, but I got Lincoln Hospital built. It was on like a 10 or 12-acre site. It was a 500-bed institution, $200 million, which was big bucks in those days. And we got a brand new, good healthcare institution for the people of the South Bronx, Lincoln Hospital.
You had some other kind of, I was interested in the book to see that you had written an article for New York Magazine at one point calling for free public transit. Now that's kind of what we call today kind of outside the box thinking. Did you actually think that was a possibility at the time and that would help New Yorkers?
Well, it was. People viewed it as a radical proposal, but I was so excited one day I got an editorial from the New York Times talking about it. Forget how they labeled it, the getting rid of the turnstiles. And what I argued was that it wasn't pie in the sky, that mass transit was inextricably linked to existence in an urban center. And just as we pay and just as we get from certain services without paying a user charge. You know, when you go to the park, you don't put in, you don't pay $2 admission to go to the park. If you have to call the fire department or the police department, they don't leave you a bill for $39.95. Certain services are delivered as part of the government of the city. And I said, why shouldn't transit be viewed in that way? And I said, the user of the transportation system, the person who goes on the bus or the subway, is not the only beneficiary of that service. It's real estate. It's department stores. It's big-time corporations. They get people transferred to their doorstep. It's no accident that Bloomingdale's is at 59th Street. There's a subway stop on the corner. Customers are delivered to them. Big corporations have their employees delivered to them by buses and subways. They get an economic benefit from the transportation system. So I said it's not just the user, the poor working guy, who should be paying for the cost of mass transit. The government should be subsidizing it and supporting it. And I had a whole proposal of how there could be a surtax that aimed at just transportation so that you didn't have to pay every time you went on the transit system. And for people in the Bronx, it was a double whammy because they eliminated free transfers. If you had to go from one bus to another bus or bus to a subway, you had to pay twice. And the price of transportation was going up. It started a nickel at a dime and then went to 15 and 25 cents, and it kept going up. I once held a press conference with a 6-foot token saying this is going to be the size of the token if we don't do something about the way in which we finance transportation. So, and by the way, Tom, I mentioned this in the book. I got one of the thrills of my life last year on this issue of free transit to show that it could be done. The city provided free bus transportation during the corona pandemic for months until I think it was all the way through September that you got on a bus and you didn't have to put the money in the fare box. Now, admittedly, a lot of the people
kind of
went
kicking and screaming
during that period of time.
kicking and screaming, the mayor went along with that idea, which people were pushing. And it does open the door to the possibility. Do you think it's a possibility that could still happen, this radical notion of yours, the free public transit?
Well, it's getting harder and harder because, you know, there are tremendous, you know, deficits and costs. But at least, you know, what I was arguing for is that at least there should be subsidization, and we did get that. The federal government mm-hmm. began to provide federal subsidies that they never did before because of this kind of advocacy, that maybe you won't get totally free fare, but you won't have to pay for the exact amount that it costs to operate the trains and the buses. And, you know, there are some free bus systems in Colorado. There are some free bus systems. There was Dime Time in Atlanta, Georgia, 10 cents, low-cost transportation during certain off hours. I was in Bologna, Italy, when they had a free transportation system. So there are places in the world where this had taken place. You know, and I argued sociologically it was not only financially, you know, the right thing to do, but I said, look, it connects families. You can visit families better if there is access to transportation. You can utilize the services of the city. So I pointed out how a free transit system would be financially beneficial, sociologically beneficial, you know, in a whole variety of ways.
All right. Well, there you go. We're going to take a short musical break. The show, again, is Deadline NYC here on WBAI FM 99.5. We're talking to the great Bob Abrams, former New York State Attorney General. And we'll be back in a moment. Reggie, you got this tune queued up for us? So I chose that, Bob, because that is the Chiffons, who graduated in 1960 from James Monroe High School in Soundview. And the tune is called My Block. It's by a guy named Jimmy Radcliffe, who came from Harlem, but it's kind of talking about what it's like to live on a tough block in a place like the Bronx. A little bit more about the Bronx before we get to, I want to move on to talk about your time at AG a lot. But there was another kind of trial by fire that you went through. In 1971, you testified in front of the New York City Council in favor of what was then a very long shot piece of legislation and in some areas very unpopular. You got hooted and jeered from the gallery as you spoke and got criticized by some of your constituents. And that was the gay rights bill in its very earliest form. It didn't even get passed until 15 years later. Tell us, what made you decide to speak in favor of it in 1971, Bob?
Well, I was a lone voice. There was this hearing at City Hall. I think I might have been the only elected official to come down and speak for it. The gallery and the balcony was filled, and there were all kinds of catcalls. When I came back to my office, my secretary, Peggy Rodriguez, said, "Where were you? What did you do this morning?" She said, "The phones are ringing off the hook. People are enraged." So it was a very unpopular view at that point in time. Why did I do it? I mean, you know, I, first of all, I was being urged by a member of my staff to do it. I felt it was the right thing to do. I talked about other members of the staff, and they actually, felt that, "Are you kidding? You're gonna get hurt. You're gonna get pummeled politically." It's not a wise thing. It's not a good thing to do. But look, I thought it was the right thing to do. I thought it was a fundamental civil rights issue. I came from a minority community, a member of the Jewish community. I lived in a city that had heavy minority representation, African Americans. There were Hispanics who were minority members in our community and others. And, you know, I felt that all people, that the American credo, this is a great country. It's a democracy. You should have full rights and everybody should be treated equally. And so sexual orientation should be one of those categories. And it took a long time. When I became attorney general, I was the first attorney general ever to issue an executive order saying that there shall be no discrimination in this office, because that's the only power I had over this office, in terms of hiring people based upon the issue of sexual orientation. And I supported it legislatively, nationally, locally. And we've come a long way. I talk about it in the book, how
In your book, Bob, you sort of tip your hat to the fellow you just referred to, I think Ethan Ghetto, who was a chief aide to you at the time. He's still active and around. I think folks might be interested just to hear a little bit about the role that he played in this, if you feel like talking about it.
Okay, well, you know, I got his permission to talk about it, you know, in the book. He was a key advisor of mine. He was my main, he was my public information officer. He's my key political advisor. And one day we were down at City Hall, and he said nervously as we were coming down the steps to City Hall, he said, "Bob, I have something important to tell you. I want to talk to you privately." And so we found a bench in City Hall Park. There was nobody around. I was the borough president of Bronx, getting ready to run for state attorney general. And Ethan began to tell me his personal story. He said, "Bob, I got to tell you this. I'm gay, and I've secreted that all my life, and I no longer feel comfortable doing that. I want to be public about it, and I don't want to hurt you. You and I, you know, we're friends. We're allies. You're my boss. I work in the office, but." You know, I want you to advance, and I'm telling you this because you're about to make a major run for statewide office and for a sensitive post, the attorney general, and this will probably be an issue, or it may become an issue, and I don't want you to suffer. And if you want me to leave, I'm prepared to leave. Not that I think I should leave because of this, but, you know, I care about you and your career. I think you have progressive views and values, and you'd do important things if you got into that office. And I said, Ethan, what are you talking about? I mean, I don't have to think about this much. You're not going to leave. You're my key advisor. I want you. I need you. I want you to stay in that office. And I believe on the merits of the issue. You should not be discriminated against on that basis. And so, you know, that helped move me along. It educated me, you know, in a personal, moving way. And, you know, what's so astonishing, Tom, is how the public's view changed. You talked about what happened when I first went down to testify in 71, and you talked about it took 15 years before New York, you know, passed the bill, and many other cities and states were ahead of New York on this issue. But what is miraculous, that within 30 or 40 years, you know, that whole issue turned around. Right. And I think one of the key things was that people began to see that their friends, that members of their family were coming up to them and saying what Ethan told me, you know, "I'm gay." You know, Vice President Cheney's daughter comes and says, you know, "I'm to a mother and father, I'm gay." They're not going to turn their back on their daughter, even though they have maybe very conservative philosophy as right-leaning Republicans. And so people all across the country, I think we're hearing these kinds of revelations. So I think that helped pave the way for more acceptance of this.
I think you helped nudge that rock up the hill. So listen, just so you get elected to the office. Ronald Reagan is president at the time. And as you describe in the book, his administration was basically actively deciding not to go to bat in all sorts of areas, ranging from civil rights to antitrust to on-the-job safety. Had you banked on that when you took the job, that you were going to have to embark on a whole lot of other areas that really had been outside the purview previously of the state AG's office?
Nope. Nope. I mean, I guess I was like a lot of people. Ronald Reagan, he's going to get elected to president of the United States, former actor. Yeah, you know, he's the governor of California. But Ronald Reagan, and he's got such reactionary views. But he won. And, you know, and like I, a lot of people say, well, you know, politicians, they say one thing on the campaign trail, and then they don't adhere to their promises once they get in office. Well, Ronald Reagan was not my guy or my kind of a guy, but I got to give him credit. He did what he said. He said he was a laissez-faire guy. If he got elected, he was going to get the government off the back of business. And that's what he did. He put the watchdog to sleep. He put the consumer watchdog to sleep. He put the civil rights watchdog to sleep. He put the environmental watchdog to sleep. All of the enforcement agencies were given the word, don't enforce the law. No antitrust enforcement. No civil rights enforcement. And so what happened? The problems got worse rather than better. The signal went out. There's no watchdog. There's no penalty if you go and cross the line and do bad things and violate the law. And the problems came to the doorstep of the states. And that gave us an opportunity. And I happen to be attorney general in a large state, and I was going to be president of the National Association of Attorneys General. And I try to build a coalition of big states and small states, liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats. It didn't matter who we were attorneys general. I was the president of the association. I said, we like each other. We respect each other. Let's work together. And people felt that this would never happen because states were always competing with one another from the earliest days of the Articles of Confederation, which failed, you know, to the current time. There was always competition among states. But we demonstrated as attorneys general in those days that we could work together, and we started multi-state investigations, multi-state prosecutions, and it made a powerful difference, like an antitrust enforcement.
The combination of a bunch of different AGs working together was crucial to your success in being able to do this. That's interesting.
You know, like, absolutely. And, you know, when I say antitrust, people might glaze. Well, antitrust. Well, I heard that word. What does it really mean? Well, it's an esoteric concept, but it's got real bread and butter pocketbook impact on issues. I mean, it means when companies get together and form create monopolies or have conspiracies and deprive consumers from having the chance at getting the best possible products at the lowest possible prices with the maximum choices. And I read a report before I became attorney general showing how there were billions of dollars taken from the wallets and pocketbooks of consumers in the country every year as a result of failure to enforce the antitrust laws. So I said, we've got to enforce the antitrust laws, we've got to enforce the environmental laws, the consumer protection laws, the civil rights laws. And as attorneys general, we began to change the nature of that office and work together. And it culminated after I left office, for example, the tobacco cases. That was done collectively. With all the states getting together, and they got a $220 billion pot of money from the tobacco industry with major reforms, not only dollars put on the table to go back to the states to pay for the kinds of cancer care and cost that was impacted on and imposed on the states, but to have changes and modifications in the way they advertised cigarette products and gave warnings and they shouldn't be targeting children. So one of the exciting things of being attorney general was to help reshape the office and work with other states across the country to create a powerful voice and force on behalf of ordinary working people.
Let me ask you about a different kind of collision that you had. It was also sort of generated by at least the Reagan era. Operation Rescue, as they called themselves, the anti-abortion group that was headed by this guy Randall Terry, came to, I guess it was Buffalo, right? That was where he chose.
Correct.
That he was going to target the clinics. And you decided to take him on and to seek injunctions. Was that a fight that you needed to do? Was that a natural area for an AG to get into?
It wasn't. And historically, it wasn't. And this, to me, was one of the exciting reasons why I ran for the office and why I stayed as long as I did. and was able to attract the kind of people to be assistant attorneys general in the office because they shared my vision. I had a view, and I respected those who were on the other side, but I had a view that a woman should have the right to control her own body. She should be able to make those personal, deeply personal decisions. And I know there's, you know, a lot of people may feel differently, and people of different religions and faiths could have different concepts and as it relates to abortion, but I had my own view. And if people didn't like the job that I did, okay, there's an opportunity. Every 4 years, you go to the polls in a primary and a general election, and you could either be reaffirmed or you can be thrown out of office. And so on the issue like gay rights, on the issue of abortion, on reproductive freedom, I flexed my muscles. I filed more briefs in the United States Supreme Court than any attorney general before in history. And when Operation Rescue threatened to come to Buffalo, they had been in Wichita, Kansas the year before, and they turned that town upside down. They caused major disruption and destruction, and they were threatening to do that in Buffalo. And the mayor of Buffalo was welcoming them with open arms. He happened to be a guy who, you know, had much more conservative views than I did, but I was able to build a lot of broad base of support based upon personal relationships. And Jimmy Griffin, I got to know when I was in the Assembly and he was in the State Senate. And when I ran for Attorney General, he supported me. But now came Operation Rescue threatening to come to Buffalo, and Jimmy Griffin saying, oh, I might welcome there. They only just want to come here to say a few prayers. You know, Jimmy, they're not going to just say a few prayers. They're going to try to close the city down. They're going to try to close the abortion clinics down. They're going to try to block the clinics, not allow women to go in and intimidate them. So I went to court and got a court order preventing that all from happening, allowing women to have the path and the space to be able to go into an abortion clinic. And I think we had an impact. They left with their, you know, head down and their hands behind them. They failed in meeting their goals in Buffalo, and I think because of what we did and forging coalitions again, we were able to make sure that women's rights were protected.
You're hearing the story, folks, from Bob Abrams, the former New York State Attorney General. The show is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, and we're here on WBAI FM 99.5. We got a few minutes left, and I want to cover two other aspects of your career, Bob. Well, let's just call them the two Al's for the time being. Well, one is, when you were AG, you got thrown a pretty hot potato by then Governor Mario Cuomo when he asked you to serve as the special prosecutor for a case involving a young teenage African-American woman who told this horrendous story of how she had been sexually assaulted and held in the woods by men, including a law enforcement officer. But she was represented by people, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, who had really refused to cooperate. It was almost an impossible situation for someone who was going to try to treat it as a criminal case. How did you feel about getting that case in the first place?
Well, it was a hot potato, that's for sure, because these very serious allegations were made by this teenage African-American girl, and the family, upon the advice of the advisors, was not cooperating. And, you know, when I first read about the case, way before I was appointed special prosecutor, I mean, the story was in the newspaper. I was reading it one morning for the first time, and my wife was near me. I said, Diane, look at this story. Oh, God, listen to this. This girl was taken, abducted for 4 days, held in the woods against her will, raped, sodomized, racial epithets, KKK written on her body, dog feces placed in her hair, found in a plastic bag. What's going on? This is not the Deep South. This is not Jim Crow. This is New York. So I was appalled, and I'm sure everybody was appalled. Any person of decency and goodwill reading that story or hearing that story would, you know, felt this is an outrage. Who did this? And we got to bring to justice anybody who did this. So fast forward a couple of months when, for a whole variety of reasons, you know, the local prosecutor stepped away from the case and a special prosecutor was appointed. The governor drops it in my lap. And there were a lot of things being said by the advisors that you'll never get justice in New York. The criminal justice system will never prosecute anybody for doing such a violation of a black teenage girl. Now, look, I feel today there's still a problem within the criminal justice system, obviously, as we have seen, as it relates to people in the black community with all this violence and killings of unarmed of black Americans, men and women. And it was true then. There were problems in the criminal justice system. But, you know, you don't say that in every case you can't get justice. And I said, I'm going to treat this case with total independence, total integrity, and that's what we did. And the more we dug in, even though there was no cooperation, oh, wait a minute, hey, this is not adding up, what this girl is saying. Wait a minute. There was no finding that there was any bruises on her body. There was a rape kit. There was no finding of any semen, in her vagina, in her anal area, in her body. There were no human hairs on her body. There was no evidence of damage or danger to her body. She was out, as she says, in the cold for 4 days. It was cold. There's no evidence of malnutrition. There's no evidence of impact of being in the cold. And then people started saying, wait a minute, we saw this a black teenage girl hanging around the apartment that her family had vacated a few months before. And she was seen in the empty apartment. And then when we looked inside the apartment, we saw that there was evidence of what happened to her, what was written on her body. We saw there were charcoal strands of a burnt piece of cloth, and then it turned out that she put this writing on herself, and somebody saw her jump into the plastic bag in which she was found. Some neighbor was vacuuming the floor and looking out the window, and so it all began to come together that, wait a minute, this is not a true story.
Now, people said some pretty tough things about you in the course of this investigation. I mean, Reverend Sharpton and others really made you the target. How did you feel about that?
Well, it wasn't pleasant to hear all kinds of accusations. But we had a grand jury do an investigation. They had a couple of hundred witnesses. They had 250 exhibits. They had 6,000 pages of testimony. We issued a 171-page report. And it clearly documented to any fair-minded person, we proved the case. We proved that this young lady unfortunately lied. I mean, people began to speculate, why did she say this? Well, she had a troubled experience and atmosphere with her stepfather, and she was fearful. She was coming in late. What was she going to say? What was the story? And she had come in late a few weeks before. And so as a result of that report that we issued, editorial boards and newspapers all across New York and indeed all across the country said, it was handled professionally. It was powerful evidence that showed that this was a fabrication. And you're right, Tom. It was a very tough period in my life. Right. I think I suffered.
Well, we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes left here. If that was a tough test, if Tawana Brawley was tough, I think your race for the United States Senate against Al D'Amato might have been even tougher. Jack Newfield, our buddy, used to say that when D'Amato was first elected, he would do one term in the U.S. Senate and one term in the Federal Correctional Facility at Leavenworth. Well, he was wrong. We were all wrong. D'Amato was a pretty nimble politician, but I think we really thought that if anybody was going to take him down, when you won the nomination, that you would be, and you almost did it. Looking back at it, what do you feel went wrong there?
It was a close race, over 6 million votes cast. It was like a 1% race. I confess that I don't think I ran a very good campaign. I made some mistakes in the course of that campaign. It was a precursor of what's happened in the 25 years since. There was a slashing campaign. There were misleading statements and ads that were made, and I was maligned in a lot of different ways, and so it became a very close race. And you're
you
right,
used the word fascist at one point, and you really got ripped for that.
I did, you know, and that's one of the mistakes. I mean, there was a reason why I used that word. I was going to a student rally in Binghamton, and it was the end of a long day, and prior in that day, we were trying to hold rallies in upstate New York, and D'Amato supporters were there preventing me from speaking, thrusting signs in front of me, and, you know, I thought that that was very abusive tactics and practices, and,
you,
and it was the end of a long
you
day.
You used a term and that a lot of New Yorkers might have agreed with. So, listen, we we've got to wrap this up in another few seconds. I just is there anything else that you just want to add in terms of looking back on this career? I mean, you're a true public servant that you're glad you did, that you wish you'd done different. We've only got a few seconds, but if there's anything that's on your mind that you'd like to voice to the WBAI audience here.
Yeah, well, one thing, you know, look, we're living in a disillusioned period, and there's so much that justifies our disillusionment. Boy, these horrifying Trump years. But the one message is, or there are a few messages from this book, and I think one of them is, you can't turn your back on politics and government. You got to roll up your sleeves. You got to get involved. Look, we won those two seats in Georgia. You know, you can prevail, although the Republicans are trying to now disenfranchise people and not allow this to happen. So one of the strong messages is you can beat the bosses, you can beat victories, win victories against big companies,
you can beat the bosses.
In this great democracy,
all right.
You know, prevail.
That's the name of the book, The Luckiest Guy in the World, My Journey in Politics. Take a look. Robert Abrams, thank you so much for being with us and talking to us about your book. Folks, if you want to have anything you want to share, reach me at deadlinenyc@gmail.com. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments with Oliver Nelson's fine-tuned Stolen Moments. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
$0.33 a day. Not much, is it? Loose change. A third of a cup of coffee. It's nothing. But did you know that 33 cents a day can help WBAI stay on the air? That's all it takes. As little as 33 cents a day, $10 a month, you can be a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit card, debit card, or from your bank account. It's safe, secure, and easy, and it helps keep our unique, alternative, and diverse programming on the air. You'll get a WBAI membership card and other goodies. Sign up online. Go to WBAI.org and click on donate. All the details are right there. The WBAI buddy. Be one today.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. Interested in becoming a member of the local station board? Well, elections for the board are coming up, so come get a taste of what it might be like to serve on the WBAI local station board by attending the next